In this episode of the Smart City Podcast, I interviewed the CEO of Car Next Door, Will Davies. We have a great chat. Will starts with talking about his background in commerce and as a mortgage broker, but then how he started to follow his passion for reducing our carbon footprint, and then how to utilize our resources better and how that fits into the smart city space. We take a bit of a deep dive into car sharing and public transport attitudes, as well as equal access to mobility. He has an exciting idea about how every new human could make the world a better place. We then talk a little bit, well, we talk a lot about what Car Next Door actually does and building trust. We then finish on talking about impacts and costs of autonomous vehicles, public transport and sharing, and the impacts that will have on infrastructure. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
It's the Smart City Podcast, whoa, with smart city experts, here we go. Connecting smart technology, both big and small. Smart cities are making life better for all. Big data, emerging trends, self-driving cars and more. Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Will. How are you?
Very good, thanks, Zoe. How are you?
I am super. It's a really beautiful day here in Toowoomba. Maybe not so good for global warming, being winter and all, but it is absolutely beautiful. So I hope it's the same down in Sydney.
It is very, very nice.
Well, let's jump straight into this podcast. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you are passionate about?
So I am 39, and I basically, when I was, I did a commerce degree, and then I got a job in a big, one of those big sort of finance firms, and I lasted there about 3 months. I absolutely hated it and quit and decided I wanted to do something myself. Like, I really wanted to be self-employed. So I did a bunch of things, but ended up becoming a mortgage broker, and ended up building the mortgage broking team into a team of about 20 and making really good money. But as I was getting older, I was becoming more and more concerned about the amount of carbon that humans are putting into the world, and decided that I really wanted to play a big part in trying to reduce that carbon, and I couldn't work out how mortgage broking was doing that. So I ended up very quickly coming to the decision that I wanted to get out of mortgage broking and get into something that was going to be make a big part of reducing carbon. So sold the mortgage broking business, which is good because, you know, there's some good money in that, and then went hunting, trying to work out what I could do that was going to be a great business and reduce carbon. So looked at a whole bunch of different things, which I won't go into, but ended up, I'd been a car sharing user, but thought it was a bit silly that you're walking past all these cars in order to get to the car that you've shared. So, set up Car Next Door to utilize people's cars, and share them rather than you having to buy a bunch of cars and sit them on the street.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of how I ended up, doing Car Next Door and where I am now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I guess, you know, we're on the Smart City Podcast. So how do you think that this kind of fits into smart cities, and what kind of, I think you already talked about what kind of sparked your interest, which is, you know, to reduce the carbon. And so how do you think this kind of fits into the smart city space?
Well, so I probably should explain what Car Next Door does in order to explain that. So Car Next Door is a peer-to-peer car sharing platform. So there's 7 million cars in Australian cities. Most people's cars, or the average car, sits around doing nothing for 95% of the time. So there's huge numbers of cars that just are completely unutilized. So what Car Next Door does is we put some technology into those cars that then makes them available for other people, other neighbors to share. So if you put your car on the platform, Zoe, and listed it, then anyone who lives around you can say, all right, there's a car here. I want to borrow it. Our technology lets them straight into the car. They drive, do whatever they need to do, drop it back, and then we charge the borrower of the car and then pay the owner. So that's our system in a nutshell. So we're kind of like the Airbnb of cars. How that fits in to smart cities is, well, there's a number of ways, but basically there's limited amounts of parking spots in cities, and there's already huge amounts of city spaces that are taken up by car spots because all of these cars are sitting around doing nothing for 95% of the time. So if we can take a car from doing something, nothing 95% of the time and make it so it's, you know, at least 20 or 30% utilized, then you need a lot less cars in the area. And so it starts to free up parking spots from just being, you know, car storage into areas, spots that can be used for higher purposes, like, you know, make more green space or better roads and pathways and things like that. And then the second thing is that, I think that smart cities need to be reducing their carbon emissions dramatically. And car sharing is a very good way of doing that because, well, there's two reasons that car sharing reduces carbon emissions. There's been a number of studies done that say that every shared car that is out on the street, it means that 10 cars don't need to get produced in the first place. So half of a car's carbon emissions are in its manufacture. So if we can take 10 cars off the road for every one that we haven't produced, there's a lot of carbon reduction there. Secondly, people who car share drive 40% less than people who own a car. And the reason for that is that if you think about, if you've got a car that you've already paid all the sunk costs for, you've already done the rego insurance, it's depreciating anyway, and you want to go up the road to get a litre of milk, you'll just take the car because it only costs like, you know, 10 cents in petrol to do that. Whereas if you don't have a car and you're car sharing and it's going to cost you $5 to rent a car, you'll go, all right, well, I'm going to use a better form of transport. I'm going to walk, or I'm going to ride my bike, or, you know, something else, catch public transport. So that effect means that people actually, yeah, drive a lot less and emit less carbon that way too.
Yeah, cool. So let's talk about what a smart city means to you.
I'd just be interested, what does a smart city mean to you first, Zoe?
So my definition that I use is pretty simple, and it's just about making our places more accessible, livable, and sustainable for all. The way to do that is by utilizing technology. So first of all, we need to look at what problems we're trying to solve, and then how technology, if it can, help us do that, rather than looking at technology as, you know, something we need to implement or want to implement, actually looking at those problems first, and the pain points of the community, and then how we can utilize technology as an enabler rather than the driver.
Oh, yeah. So look, certainly don't disagree with anything that you said there. That makes a lot of sense. I guess for me, making a place more livable and happier, a happier place for people to live, is definitely a big part of it. And also just doing more with less. There's just a huge amount of waste that we're emitting everywhere. We can just be so much more efficient. And I think that I completely agree that technology is the way forward, is a great way forward for us to do that. I think that, you know, certain things like car sharing and what we're doing is completely enabled by technology. It would be near impossible. Well, it would be impossible to do what we're doing without the internet, without mobile technology. So all those other building blocks that have come in place. I kind of want to see I know this might sound ridiculous, but I mean, toying with the idea that we need to get the world to a stage where every new human, it makes the world a better place environmentally. So rather than at the moment, every new human that's born, you know, we can count how much extra they're going to bugger the planet up, each on an individual basis. We need to make it so that each new person is a net positive to the planet. I think that, you know, that's kind of the end game. And I think smart cities are definitely a way towards doing that.
I love that. And I totally agree. And I mean, obviously it's easier said than done, but I think that definitely sustainability, I mean, I know it's a bit of a hashtag sustainability, but
that net positive is really important to think about. And I think it actually, some of it, yes, technology can be used as an enabler, but actually a lot of it is mindset change. So, you know, a circular economy, you know, reducing our waste, all those type of things. You know, it's an educational piece rather than a, oh, well, this technology will help me, I don't know, reduce my waste by telling me when I'm, I don't know, throwing this in the wrong bin or whatever it is. That doesn't help, but you know what I'm trying to be on about.
Yeah, it's not only technology. It's also there's so much that we could do right now to improve our, like, reduce our waste and to live better lives that doesn't require technology. It just requires a mind shift. For example, if more people were to embrace public transport than what currently have, we would have much more frequent services. Everyone would be getting around a lot cheaper and a lot quicker because there wouldn't be all this congestion on the road. But the problem is that everyone is just so stuck on it's kind of like prisoner's dilemma or the tragedy of the commons. I don't know if you ever did economics, but where it's slightly better for an individual to take the car, and so everyone gets in the car, and then it makes it much worse for everyone else. So yeah, there's heaps of that, which has got nothing to do with technology, but.
Yeah, it's like the meme where, you know, old mate stuck in traffic and, you know, the little thought bubble is, oh, why are there so many people on the road? It's like, yeah, well.
You're one of them.
Yeah, exactly. And I, why can't more people be riding their bikes or whatever? It starts with the individual, I guess. I mean, for public transport, for example, I just think that in the cities that you can have public transport that's, you know, reliable and accessible and all those type of things. I find it really difficult in the regions to have that same conversation. And then how does it work? It will look different. Yeah, I think the car next door kind of, or the ride share, car sharing kind of aspect could really be useful in the regional areas because you don't necessarily have access to public transport. And it might change our mindset if we're only sharing a car, then, like you said, walking down the road instead of driving or cycling or whatever, if we can. So, yeah, cool. So I think we've talked about why this concept is so important. So let's talk about how you think Australia is embracing this smart city concept.
Well, I think that like any country, any group of people, I think there's a large number of people who would be completely embracing of the smart city concept. And then there's going to be plenty of people who think that, you know, the way things are is perfectly fine and we don't need to make any changes. And it's often that there's clear, sometimes animosity between the two groups. So I don't know if saying, all right, is Australia on the whole embracing it or not? I don't know if that's, you know, that's happening. Like, so for example, going back to the public transport example. So let's say that some really credible research was done that said, if everyone in Sydney, if you had to pay, you know, a buck per kilometre that you drive a car in Sydney, then everyone would move to public transport and then they could get heaps more public transport on and it'd just be way better for everyone to get around cheaper and easier and faster than they currently do because we wouldn't have all this congestion. So there would be a group of people, like, and I'd be in this, who'd go, that is an awesome idea, fully embrace that, happy to take the hit if I ever drive a car because I'm just going to switch my usage to public transport. And then there'd be another group of people who are like, you know, it's my right to be able to drive a car. How dare you? I'm going to vote you out of power. And chances are that there's probably more of those people, than there are of people like me. And so, so that change can't be implemented or even sort of minor steps towards that change can't be implemented. So I think that Australia's on the whole got a very long way to go before, we really start to look at these issues on a holistic, you know, what's the best for everyone here? What's going to get everyone a better outcome rather than an individual, you know, I like my car. I don't care how much it buggers everyone else up. That's what I want to do kind of basis. So I'm not hugely optimistic that I don't think that Australia is like hell bent on pushing in that direction. I really hope that it moves more in that way though. And I don't know if it's just going to take a big shock for that to happen. Like maybe things are going to have to get so bad that, that it just becomes a lot more clear to a lot more people that that's the only way forward to really start looking at these things on that kind of scale. Like, you know, in London, they've got the congestion fee. And if you go within the London walls, then you've got to pay an extra, you know, quite a big fee to get in there. And that just basically stops people driving their car, in the center of London, which is, I think, universally praised as being a great thing for everyone to do.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. I'm going to start looking at road charging soon because I'm really interested to do a bit more research and study how it's been implemented in other countries and how it's kind of seen to work and how we make sure that it's equitable as well, like, you know, equal access to mobility. So, yeah, it should be really interesting.
Yeah, because I mean that's another issue. Like, you know, you start charging a buck per kilometre. Does that just mean that rich people get the roads themselves, whilst everyone else is, you know, jammed in public transport because they can't afford to drive anymore? These are all the issues that come up. But we're just living in this suboptimal system with so much stuff. I think transport's a huge one. What are some other massive suboptimal positions we've got ourselves in?
If you're asking my opinion, I think transport definitely, as we're already talking about, I think also just inefficient processes within, you know, governments and councils that are really based on clunky systems that are decades old, and they're kind of untouchable in the fact that, oh no, that's the way it's always been done and we can't possibly change it because otherwise we'd have to change these 5 other or 15 or 50 other clunky systems that it sits on top of. And so I think there's lots of really easy technology solutions that are available right now or have been available for the last 10 years, but it's actually about utilizing and implementing those appropriately within our governments and councils. But then it's also about having the right skill sets within those governments and councils. So then it's also about attracting those to governments and councils. So yeah, it's like my biggest passion is one, building smarts in the regions, but also those boring, inefficient processes. I really want to see those become more efficient because then we have extra money to spend on the community where, you know, they need it most. And then, you know, that makes our lives more accessible, livable and sustainable.
Yeah. No, I kind of had a bit of experience with that. My place at Randwick in Sydney, and I decided to rent it out on Airbnb, and one of our neighbours complained. This is just like, so I'd go away. We went on holidays for 2 weeks, so I'd rent it out during that period. One of our neighbours complained, and so I went through this process trying to find out what the Randwick Council's position was on Airbnb and if it was actually legal to do it or not. And I ended up having to, like, I spent hours and hours trying to work it out. There's nothing on their website. I had to speak to 3 or 4 people to finally get an answer on what their position was on it. And you're talking about a system to allow more efficient use of housing, and the council's, you know, 3 or 4 years into Airbnb being there, still haven't got a position on it yet. So, you know, that's probably a small example of it, but there's heaps of different areas, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I think even just like things that aren't new, like, you know, we have to maintain our roads, for example, doing that manually, as in, I mean, you still need people on the ground doing things that require human smarts, I should say, and decision making and all that kind of stuff. That's what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is actually, you know, assessing the roads manually in the first instance, using simple machine learning. I call it simple. I shouldn't call it simple, but using machine learning to at least flag issues in the first instance would dramatically improve the way that we can maintain our roads and reduce the number of just inefficiencies to the point where you still, this isn't taking away human jobs. This is actually allowing a government or council or whoever it is to be more efficient. And so all the things that they never get around to doing because there's never enough money, you know, can be solved. And then also that reduces your customer complaints, which, you know, then reduces, your impact on the people taking the customer complaints and even the customer complaint system and all that kind of stuff. And I just think that it also is a bit of the unknown. Like, I don't think we necessarily, know what we're doing now with data, like what data we have, how we're using it, and then what we can do better. And I think that kind of audit's a boring word, but like, self-assessment or check or whatever. If we can do that first to then go, okay, this is where we're at when it comes to whatever you want to call it, smart cities or, you know, just data management or whatever it is, then we can actually start implementing processes that will improve that. Whereas if we are all in the dark and don't know, we'll just keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, this podcast is becoming about me, which, you know, I don't mind, but let's talk about you some more. let's talk about some of the projects and things that you're working on right now. Obviously, you've got Car Next Door. So I'm really keen to you've already told us a little bit about how that works and how did you come up with this idea? I mean, we talked about that a little bit, but I'm really keen to know how long you've kind of been doing this and what you see coming next.
Yeah. So when I sold the mortgage broking business and I said, right, I'm going to do something that's going to help reduce carbon. So I took a look at importing solar panels, into Australia because I thought that would be a good thing to do. But that kind of freaked me out because, you know, there's heavy government, subsidies on it. And if they got dropped, then you could be left with it in a pretty nasty situation. Plus the technology was just changing so quickly. I looked at aquaponics, which is where you breed fish and the fish poo in the water and that fertilizes plants and then that plant cleans the water and then you make this little ecosystem. But that didn't go particularly well for me. There are some businesses doing that now though. But I'd been a car sharing user. So I started to look at it but obviously in the peer-to-peer sense, so using people's cars. So I kind of took a look overseas. This is back in 2011 and saw that there were some real fledgling businesses just getting going on that front. And I kind of watched them for a few months, but then basically you get to this point where I'd done a bunch of research on it. Like I'd done a big survey of people. I'd taken a look at other traditional car sharing operators, like where they own the cars, and they seem to be doing well. So I'd kind of done all this research and it sort of just comes to the point where, all right, I don't know if this is going to work, but I'm going to give it a shot. This is what I'm going to do. And so that was 2011. And so we're now 2018. So it's literally, is that 7 years since I made that decision, that I've been doing this?
Good maths.
It's tough. I was going to say eight, but then, you know, thought I'd wind it back. Like I'm a big believer in just knuckling down and just focusing on the one thing. So I've tried to not let myself get distracted by other ideas, of which I have many, but I've kind of, you know, I just jot them down and I'll save them for later. One of the big things that we're working on now is we're looking to create a version of Car Next Door that can be Australia-wide. Because we've got to put the technology into each car, we've kind of limited ourselves to just the cities. So we're basically only in the inner city of Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and the Gold Coast, and a few in Newcastle. That's where we're at the moment. But we're going to make a version of Car Next Door where we don't put any technology in the car and the people just meet to exchange keys. And that's going to be, Australia wide. So, we're hoping that we can spread it out a lot wider. You know, and get a lot broader reach doing that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we're thinking at the moment. But where I think in the long term everything's heading is I'm, you know, obviously look a lot at driverless cars and robo taxis and how they're going to fit in. And I'm very strongly of the view that in the next 3 to 5 years, you'll be able to get picked up by a driverless robo taxi, take it where you want to go for very, very little money. Because if you think about a robo-taxi, it's basically, let's say this thing costs a bit more than a car costs because it's got all the technology in it. But it won't be a huge amount more once they start building them at scale. So this is like a driverless taxi. You press a button on your phone, this vehicle comes and picks you up, takes you where you want to go. Doesn't cost very much, costs about the same to drive as a car. But then you don't have the thing sitting, you know, you get out and then it goes and picks someone else up. So you don't have all these huge standing costs that we've currently got. So I think that most people in Australia within 10 years, if the average person is paying sort of $7,000 or $8,000 for personal transport at the moment, I think that cost is going to go right down to sort of $1,000 to $2,000, and it's going to be heaps more efficient because it won't be just driverless cars, robo-taxi cars. It'll be also robo-taxi minibuses and buses, and we're going to be able to get people very, very efficiently all going in the same, people all going in the same direction on the same vehicle, and it's going to cost very little and be hugely efficient. So I think that's the world that we're going to be living in another 10 years. I don't think it's very far away. Google already has robo-taxis driving around in Phoenix right now without any drivers picking people up. So, you know, the technology is largely there. It's just going to take a while for it to fill out. So I think that's the massive change that's going to happen. And we're really keen to be a big part of that. Still trying to work out exactly how we're going to fit into that, but that's where we think it's going.
Yeah, cool. Now I have a lot of things whirring around in my brain because I'm just about to. Well, I haven't got it yet, but I'm looking at a Churchill Fellowship to go over and look at smart mobility, whatever the hell that means. So I want to look at connected autonomous vehicles. That's my background, but more on the impacts, not necessarily the technology. And then also that the sharing economy, how that fits into it, mobility as a service, all these things. So I'm really keen to share some thoughts. Okay, let's move on to integration. Now, keen to hear your thoughts about integrating across different disciplines, governments, and industries. I wonder how, like, you've obviously, maybe you could tell us what you've had to kind of do to get Car Next Door up and running. I assume there was maybe some regulation and, you know, convincing people and all that kind of stuff. So how did you get around that, or how did you integrate across the different disciplines that you would have come across?
Well, we luckily, most of the laws that were written in New South Wales and Victoria were written, obviously they were written without considering that there was ever going to be peer-to-peer car sharing involved. And so luckily for us, the way that they were written means that there is nothing explicitly regulating against peer-to-peer car sharing. So we've been able to just operate, like get peer-to-peer car sharing going in New South Wales and Victoria without any real change. Queensland's a different story. They've sort of specifically, the law's been written in a particular type of way that makes it very hard to do any kind of innovation. So we're attempting to get things changed in Queensland, but they don't really care so far. So that's where we're at. So our approach there was, all right, well, let's just start in the places where we can do it, which is New South Wales and then Victoria. The big thing with what we're doing is just with regards to building our marketplace up, is we are a two-sided network. We're building a network. People are only going to want to put their cars on our platform if there's plenty of people who are going to borrow it. And people are only going to want to borrow cars if there's actually cars there. So we need to build that network on both sides. So the way we got Car Next Door started was we just started in Bondi, so one suburb of Sydney. And we became very quickly the biggest car sharing operation in Bondi. So we had 30 cars in Bondi when, you know, the next biggest car share might have only had 20 or something like that. So if you lived in Bondi, we were a really good option for you. We had a good coverage of cars and good liquidity of cars for you. And so we were able to build the network up in Bondi only. And then we took that. We obviously needed to raise some more money then. We were able to say to investors, hey, look, this is what we've done in Bondi. Now we're going to do it across more areas and raise more money like that. That was opposed to, we had a competitor who started and they tried to just go Australia wide right from the start. And they had like, you know, two cars in Melbourne, three cars in Sydney, car up in Darwin, and just never got any critical mass or never built a network up anywhere, and they shut down. So that's probably the two, the regulatory stuff we've just avoided anywhere that's tough, so far, and then building the marketplace up, you know, the human marketing side of it have been the main areas that we've had to contend with.
Yeah. So I'm interested to, like, obviously with Airbnb, people now trust that, you know, people are going to be, I don't know, not destroy your house, and there's some things in place. What have you had to put in place for Car Next Door?
With regards to trust or?
Yeah, and in regards to, like, if, you know, if there's an accident or, you know, if someone, I don't know, messes up your car or something like that. Like, what have you had to put in place? Because obviously, yeah, you have to build that trust.
Yeah, and that just that comes over time. So, yeah, we've put a lot of things in place. So, firstly, we've built very strong systems for catch. Unfortunately, there's people out there who are just sketchy, shitty people, and you don't want them in other people's cars. So a big part of what we've done over the years is we've built better and better ways to catch if people are dodgy people. And we've got a whole bunch of ways of doing that, which I won't go into any of the details for obvious reasons. The second thing is we've got insurance that covers the owner and the borrower of the car. So if the borrower crashes the car, then yeah, the owner needs to feel really comfortable that their car's going to get, you know, replaced or repaired properly. So that's really just something like that's been our policy right from the start. Obviously, it'd be very hard to run the business, but that's just stuff that builds up over time. So over the last 7 years, we've built up our reputation, and then more and more people tell their friends about it, and a huge amount of our new users on both owners and borrower sides, so the cars and the borrowers come through referral. So, and you've just got to do time in the market, and you've got to behave properly for a long time in the market, and then that starts to flow through. And yeah, it's probably the same with Airbnb. Like, you know, I found out about Airbnb through my sister-in-law. And if she'd had a crappy experience where she was ripped off, she wouldn't have used it and she wouldn't have told me. And that's how most of these things get built.
Mm, definitely. Cool. Okay. So let's talk about emerging trends. What do you think people aren't talking about enough?
Look, I probably sound like a bit of a broken record, but the whole driverless car thing, I think it's an extremely talked about topic, but I don't know if many people have really thought through the ramifications, what things are going to be like when we live in a completely a driverless car world. The fact that it's going to become so cheap that, you know, I was kind of talking about if everyone could just switch to public transport, then that'd be better for everyone. I think that world is going to happen because driverless vehicles are going to be so cheap that everyone's going to get rid of their cars because it's just not going to make sense anymore. You can press a button, a vehicle comes and picks you up, takes you where you want to go just as fast as you can in your own car. But now you don't have to drive and you don't have to worry about buying the car or crashing it. And it's going to cost about a quarter of the cost compared to owning your own car. So once you've got that kind of world happening and everyone's getting rid of their cars, everyone's driving around and everyone's just getting driven around in robo-taxis, then you've got this huge pool of people who are now transport as a service users. And so when they press their button, they'll now get the choice of, all right, do I want to get a private robo-taxi for, you know, 30 cents a kilometre, or do I want to get on a bus that's only going to take me 3 or 4 extra minutes with another 30 other people, and it's going to cost me 10 cents a kilometre. And so they all say, right, I'm going to take the bus. And because everyone starts to do that, then there'll be heaps of bus services. So I think driverless vehicles and robo-taxis are pretty much going to replace public transport eventually. And I think a lot of the public transport infrastructure that's being built at the moment, like there's a huge rail, a huge light rail going in to connect Randwick to the city. It's costing billions of dollars, and I think it'll be completely useless in about 10 or 15 years because driverless buses, driverless cars will be able to take everyone where they need to go super efficiently on the existing road infrastructure that we've got.
And how do you think that, like, is it? It's just obvious, right, that if they're all going to be electric or some kind of other form of, you know, low emission
hydrogen fuel cell or something. Yeah,
hydrogen fuel cell. And I guess that it goes back to that regulation, that maybe that's what will actually drive that change in regulation, because governments will suddenly not be able to gather the tax that they currently get. If people aren't owning cars, there's no licenses, there's no registration, there's no fuel tax. So that might nudge them in the direction more quickly than, you know, if there wasn't this, you know, huge economic impact.
Yeah, but I think that there's going to be plenty of ways that the government will be able to. I mean, they're still going to have to maintain the roads, and that's going to have to come from somewhere. So, but I think given that everything will be one huge big system, that it's going to be quite easy to add some sort of surcharge, you know. So maybe instead of it costing me 30 cents a kilometre to get in a driverless car, it costs me 33 cents a kilometre or something like that. So definitely, yeah, the way that they're taxing is going to change, but it should be fairly easy to continue to tax in some respect.
I think technically and yes, it's easy, but it actually takes some change now to be able to do that effectively. Otherwise, you know, we'll get Uberized again. Yeah. So last question, how can people connect with you?
So the best way to connect with me, well, obviously our website is carnextdoor.com.au. If you're looking to join, I'm not a big social media person, but my email is just will@carnextdoor.com.au.
Excellent. I'll put all those links and everything in the show notes. It was so great to speak with you, and I look forward to chatting again soon, definitely about that smart mobility stuff. So thanks
fantastic.
So much, Will. Talk soon.
Great to speak to you, Zoe. Speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
It's the Smart City Podcast. Whoa.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart City Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes can be found at thesmartcitypodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for me or any of my guests, connect with me via email, zoe@thesmartcitypodcast.com, or via the socials. I'm on Twitter and Facebook @smartcitypod. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.